Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Recently, a rather thick volume from the publisher Pegasus Books arrived in my mailbox, and I was delighted to find that it was about one of my favorite subjects, the moon. Titled Still as Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow, it's a very personal story by author Christopher Kokinos. His childhood story and relationship with his father is woven into an expansive look at our natural satellite, from the musings of ancient cultures to the dawn of the telescopic era of Galileo, which helped spark the scientific revolution. Astronomers competed to map the moon by telescope, and that eventually folds into the space race in the 1960s, and NASA's quest for the moon sparked by President John F. Kennedy. As a child, the moon loomed large in my consciousness due to the Apollo program, and because space was deeply embedded in pop culture, showing up on TV sitcoms like I Dream of Jeannie and, of course, the original Star Trek series. As a kid, I wanted to explore the moon too, and I did, with my first telescope viewing from our driveway in Southern California, while often up in the skies were the strange vapor trails created by the rockets being tested nearby. So this book definitely resonated with me, and it's my pleasure to have author Christopher Kokinos join us now. Chris, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show.
It's really cool to have you. And like I said, I really enjoyed this book.
I'm glad.
It definitely resonated with me a lot. But I'd like to know about you. Like, tell us how you first got interested in the moon. How did that, because you obviously have a passion for the moon, lifelong passion, but what was the initial spark, do you think?
You know, I do have a passion for the moon, and it really came in two phases. As the book, there's a memoir element in this book, it was sort of a boy and his telescope story, and I watched the Apollo landings when I was a kid, and I tape recorded the missions and would play them back in my bedroom in Indianapolis. It's a, you know, kind of aspiration for something better than my life at the time. And so, but that interest in the moon was inflected through those missions, right? And then I became a stargazer, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s, had a telescope, would take it out into the country. This is in Kansas and then Utah. And I kind of didn't pay that close attention to the moon, which was ironic given my childhood interest. But then I really fell in love with the moon when I moved to Tucson, and I was in the middle of, you know, sort of some of the questions that we all ask in the sort of second half of our lives. And I hadn't been able to take the telescope out, living in the city and you know, working too hard and all of those things. And having that time with the telescope was always meditative for me. But then there was the moon over the backyard, or one of our backyards in Tucson. And this was right about when the 50th anniversary of the Apollo landing, the Apollo 11 landing, was beginning to percolate. And it was also the anniversary of a forgotten picture of the century of the moon. And that was something I was interested in. I've always been interested in forgotten anniversaries. So all of that sort of, you know, came together, it converged, that there was a night in the backyard where the moon was up. Like, I'm taking my telescope out, I'm going to look at the moon for the first time, really seriously. And all of this historical material sort of beginning to percolate up, which is something that has always fascinated me just as a person, but also as a writer.
How long did it take for you, once you decided to write it, to complete it? Because this is a magnum opus here.
Thank you. Yeah, it took me 6 years, which ironically is the shortest it's taken me to write my bigger nonfiction books. I did a book on meteorites called The Fallen Sky that took 8 years. And then I did a book on my first nonfiction book on extinct North American birds, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. And that took 10 years. So the irony is that between The Fallen Sky and this book, Still as Bright, it was, gosh, I want to say like 15-year gap. And I was doing other things. I'm a poet as well, and writing essays, and co-edited an anthology, actually. This was also sort of fed into it, called Beyond Earth's Edge, which is about the poetry of spaceflight. So it was on my mind. You know, all those things were beginning to sort of percolate, as I say. And the writing of the book really went in sort of slow paces. My agent had retired by that time. I didn't have a contract, you know, which is not uncommon for a book like this. So I felt no pressure. And it was just my kind of falling in love with the moon as a place, as an archive of, you know, timekeeping, of religion, of science, of art and culture, and as a place. So looking through the telescope is, as you know, having read the book, like that's a really important part of this book, encountering that landscape as much on its own terms as possible. So the process of writing it was really a pleasure.
Yeah, and we'll get into more about your telescopic journeys a little later. But you mentioned a picture, the picture of the century that I bet most people are not aware of. But I knew this picture as soon as I saw it. I remember that.
Oh, great.
It's a wonderful picture of the floor of the crater Copernicus. And it's just, it's so rugged. And, you know, it looks like you're there standing on the rim of the crater looking across it. It's just a magnificent picture. Tell us a bit about it.
So that picture was taken in 1966. And it's one of the really, I think, the first historical narrative that I offer in the book, in the prologue, when I'm writing about, you know, sort of my falling in love with the moon and looking at it through my telescope. And then there was this craft that we, you know, was sent several, you know, orbiting probes and landers and instruments to the moon prior to the Apollo missions, because frankly, we didn't know that much about the surface. And even into the preparations for the first human landing, there were still concerns about, you know, the miles and miles of dust that might swallow up the astronauts. So we sent these probes and they were taking pictures to map the surface of the moon for safe landing sites for Apollo. But in the mechanism, the way the system was set up, this was film, and this was the lunar orbiter. The film was developed in a bay on, it's this beautifully old tech, and you know, it was developed in the spacecraft, film developing bay in the spacecraft, then scanned, then transmitted to Earth, and then reconstituted as an image. Well, one of the engineers for this probe in 1966 said, you know, we have to use up some of this film the way the camera was set up. And so it couldn't always take pictures of landing sites. Let's take a picture of this crater. And he knew, this is a fellow named Douglas Lloyd. He worked for a contractor called Bellcom. And he knew it would be spectacular because Copernicus is a magnificent crater. And going back to the early telescopic, you know, astronomers who were paying attention to the moon, it was called the monarch of the moon, the queen of the moon. It's the size of Rhode Island. It's this highly rugged, as you say, terraced crater. It's beautiful. And so lunar orbiter probe here took a photograph at an oblique angle. And it was the first such picture that we had ever seen. This was run on newspaper front pages around the world. And so it was hailed as a picture of a century. And it's still spectacular. It's still a breathtaking view. It was compared to the Badlands of South Dakota, the Grand Canyon, the Wasatch of Utah, where I live now in northern Utah. And it would be equivalent to, you know, those first amazing pictures from Hubble that we all were just wowed by. When those images came, once they fixed the image or the camera on Hubble and we had a clear view. So that picture of Copernicus was our first, I think, otherworldly sense of a place. Like, this is a real place. This is what it would be like, as you say, to stand on the rim of that crater.
The structure of the book is interesting because it's part personal memoir about you and your life and growing up and your passion for the moon. And then it's also part a history of the moon and our ideas about it through time. The amount of detail you go into and research is very impressive. And I learned a lot. I enjoyed this very much. But so many interesting characters show up. There's just a few, you know, you got to read the book if you want to know all about these things. But one of them that I, you know, was struck by was William Henry Pickering, W.H. Yes. Pickering. What a character he was. Tell us a bit about him and some of the things you found out about him.
Oh, yes. Poor W.H. Pickering. He was the last in a long line of quote unquote selenographers, you know, selene the moon, you know, so selenographers, astronomers who are studying the moon from the time of Galileo on, right? When Galileo first perfects a telescope and looks at the moon for the first time in the early 17th century. Well, Pickering is part of this lineage of selenographers, of astronomers and other thinkers, philosophers, even theologians, who looked at the moon as a place where life had to be, you know, because God would not waste a planet or a moon. There had to be life there. Pickering is a really good observer and discovered a lot of features on the moon that had previously not been spotted. And I just want, you know, the listeners to imagine the long nights, cold nights, sitting at these telescopes, some of which might be 3 inches in aperture with lenses or a refractor. And so really working hard, okay, hard on the eyesight, hard on the body, physically difficult. He discovers all these channels on the moon called rills that are caused by various, you know, geologic forces. But he also imagines life, and he is tracking changes in various places on the moon. Weather, he thinks he sees snowstorms in the, you know, the central peaks of the crater Theophilus, which, you know, again, borrow a telescope from the public library. You can look at that peak and imagine a snowstorm over that crater. He wasn't seeing that. And he wasn't seeing, although he believed he was seeing, insects migrating across the crater Eratosthenes, or vegetation changing because of seasons. It's very much an echo of what Percival Lowell and others in that camp were saying about Mars in the late 19th and early 20th century. Pickering saying the same thing about the moon. This is at a time when it has been established. There is no surface water. There's no liquid water on the moon. It has a very thin atmosphere. So Pickering retreats into a kind of hostile minority and really goes to his grave believing he's the one person who understands the true nature of the moon. It puts him at odds with his brother. There's a falling out of his brother as a fellow astronomer. So it's really, you know, a dramatic and sad ending to this otherwise fascinating chapter in lunar history, in which we did imagine that there were creatures living up there, or at least plants.
Yeah, it was really interesting to read about him. Okay, let's talk about telescopes a bit. Your very first telescope, as I recall from the book, it was a very similar experience to what I had. I remember the Edmund Scientific Catalog, that and Boy's Life magazine, you know, looking at the ads in the back. But I remember Edmund Scientific just loving to look through there at all. You could buy a laser and you could get lenses. Yes. And then, oh, look at this thing you could. And, you know, as a kid interested in science, you know, that was just a magical catalog. And I remember, you know, talking my parents into for Christmas, getting me that 3-inch reflector that you got too. And I remember, you know, looking at the picture, thinking it was going to be this beautiful gleaming white metal tube. And then it came and it was like, wait a minute, this is cardboard. Yeah. This is not metal. What the heck is this? Tell us about your experience with your Edmund 3-inch telescope, this Space Master.
The Space Conqueror.
Space yes. Conqueror,
yeah,
right.
Not just a master of space, but this sucker's
going
to conquer
space. Conquer it, yes.
Well, not so much, as it turns out. It, as you mentioned, you know, there is this memoir element to the book, and I dedicate it to my father. I write about him some in Still as Bright, in part because the moon, you know, prompts the thinking about resurrection and birth and death, and you know, has that, you know, deep symbolism. Well, he gave me a telescope. He gave me that telescope. I don't recall the precise circumstances of this. And I was just wowed by this. I also remember looking at the Edmund Scientific Catalog. And so I got this telescope as a young boy in an awkward family that ultimately sort of broke apart. And I had trouble with that telescope, as I'm sure you did as well. It's a very tetchy little mount. And so I would look at the moon when I could. I would look at the moon, but it was always really hard to aim and really hard to keep something in focus. So it was better than a toy telescope of the kind you might get at a department store, you know, at that time. Or,
but not by much.
Not by much. Not by much. It looked pretty cool, though. I agree. I mean, it's fiberboard. It's white fiberboard. I'm looking at it right now here in my study. So I lose the telescope. Over time, you know, it's like, in a sense, lose my father, or it's a divorce. And this was, again, where the space age is this refuge for me, as I think it was for a lot of people, is a sense of aspiration. And for me, you know, very personal, because it was an unhappy childhood. But that sense of wonder that came from everything from, you know, looking at the, you know, the Edmund Scientific catalog to those few glimpses that I would have of the moon, that I'd like to think that stayed with me. So as I grew older and, you know, lost some interest in that, maybe there was that substrate that was still there. And I eventually bought a small telescope when I was living in Kansas, graduated to a bigger one. When my wife and I were first in Utah, when we left, came back. And so that for those first few years, I had a concussion and I had some agoraphobia. And my therapist said, well, go to stores when it's not peak, you know, shopping hour. So I went to basically what is the Utah version of Goodwill called Deseret Industries, run by the Mormon church. And I walk in, I'm unsteady, I'm unhappy. I mean, if you've had a concussion and post-concussion syndrome, it's really unpleasant. And so I'm sort of unsteadily walking through the bins, you know, or the racks with, you know, old shoes and CDs and that sort of stuff. And there's my telescope in this glass case. And I was staggered and actually started to cry. I couldn't believe it. It was in really good shape too. I had to imagine, of course, that it was my, you know, childhood telescope. Somehow it had made its way to Logan, Utah. And I bought it and kept it and bought some eyepieces for it and occasionally, you know, would use it. It was dirty. It was still hard to sort of aim and use. But to bring the story to a close, when I learned that my father was dying of cancer, I decided I would restore the telescope. And at the time, I was also reading Galileo's Starry Messenger. And I had this sense of how, and I think this is true for anybody, if you look through a telescope, you are in that lineage of people starting from Galileo. Like, you are in that lineage. And so looking at the moon through this little 3-inch reflector, much better telescope than Galileo's, by the way, it, for me, even though it can be a little difficult to use even today, it puts me in touch with, you know, the legacy of Galileo and the selenographers, and puts me in touch with, you know, my father who gave me that telescope when I was a kid.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Christopher Kokinos as we discuss his new book, Still as Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Christopher Kokinos, author of the new book, Still as Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow.
You know, the thing I would say is just to recognize what an outsized role the moon has played in the formation of our planet, you know, was the evolution of life. We have seasons because of the impact that created the moon and tilted the earth, and the moon keeping it in place. So it has this crucial physical, right, material role for us and for the planet. And again, you know, the deep cultural, religious symbolism, art, and all of that is just wrapped up in it. So I always like to just have that in mind as I also encounter it in the history of it as a physical object, because it wasn't understood until Galileo looks at it through his telescope. It's like the telescope hour here, that it's a world, you know, that it's actually a place. It's physically a place. Prior to that, it's seen as a sacred, and of course, it's still sacred to many cultures today, but it was seen before the telescope as this smooth sphere, perfectly smooth sphere, or perfectly smooth circle placed there in the orderly heavens, which orbited, of course, and rotated around the earth. And we, you know, come to understand, of course, that that's wrong. So Galileo initiates this tradition because the telescope reveals light and shadow changing apparent typography. He sees craters. He doesn't call them craters, but that's what he's looking at. He's seeing mountains because of the way the line between light and dark is so jagged. He infers topography. So, wow, okay, so the moon is a place. What is it then? So that's when the real exploration of the moon happens. Way before Apollo, we have men, and mostly in Europe and the United States, and there's some interesting cultural reasons why that's the case that we can talk about, but they are trying to understand what it's made of. Is it formed through impacts, these landscape features? Is it formed through volcanic activity? Is there air? What's the temperature? And all of these things. And so telescopes are brought to bear like, you know, the 18th and 19th century version of the spaceship. You know, you're looking at the moon to try to understand these features, and it's dizzying. So, you know, the first time you look at the moon, I think it's just like, it's incredible. The amount of detail that you can see through even binoculars is astonishing, and it can be overwhelming. And so I'm in awe of these astronomers, these selenographers, primarily in the 18th and 19th century, who begin to do very precise maps. And there's also this sort of procession of ego involved in making the best maps and who names the features. And so there are these different selenographers who proclaim, you know, I've got the mapping system. These are the terms that we're going to use from, say, Catholic royalty. Well, those didn't last. Other names come along. So it's a kind of early space age, really, this mapping and naming of the moon in the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah, and some of those detailed drawings that they did and are just, they're just amazing to think of, you know, sitting there looking through the telescope and drawing all that and then turning it into maps. It's just what a staggering amount of work.
A staggering amount of work, and some of them go blind as a result, you know, because it's an incredible strain to be at the telescope for that amount of time. And I have only had just a tiny sample of that, where I might huddle over my 10-inch Dobsonian reflector in a parka in winter and cold weather for an hour and a half. And I'm not drawing maps. I'm using their maps. Like, I'm trying to find, what is this mountain I'm looking at? How do I identify this? What's the story? How did this landscape feature, this beautiful, you know, majestic valley come to be? So I'm not actually doing that level of diligent work, where they are having to look, to draw, and to be mathematically precise. It's pretty incredible.
There's a photograph in your book of something that I'd seen before, and it also staggers my imagination to think about producing this. It's a plaster of Paris model,
yes,
of a part of the moon that's very interesting to look at through a telescope. The Alpine Valley is in it, this beautiful straight-walled valley,
yeah,
that I've seen through a telescope many times. I'm sure you have more than I have.
Yeah.
But what a cool thing that is to think about producing that kind of detailed model.
It was, and it's a great story. And part of the difficulty of writing this book, part of the pleasure of writing it was that it was during COVID and I could just go outside and, you know, work at the telescope. But it also restricted travel. So I actually never got to see the original models. I think there's one left in London. So this is James Naismith and James Carpenter, who were two of those 19th century selenographers, really dominated by Germans and Brits for some reason, and then some Americans. And they made these incredibly precise drawings and maps of the moon. Then they took those, made these plaster of Paris models, and then they took photographs of them. And those photographs are incredible. And they're so hyper-realistic. And actually, one of the challenges that I took upon myself when I was reading about them, and, you know, like you learning my way around the moon, learning that landscape as though it were a second home to where I, you know, living in the American West, was to compare. And like, what did they get right? What did they exaggerate? Because one of the things that happens in the 19th century, even though astronomers then knew, of course, that rounded objects are going to can cast sharp shadows, the mountains are rendered as really sharp, right? Razor-edged. and more like the Himalayas than the Smokies, for example. And that's a kind of fictional moon, and that fictional moon persists into the 20th century. Even NASA in the 1960s, after they've had the picture of the century, after they've been there with, you know, camera-toting satellites, they're depicting in art for Apollo these really rugged, sharp-pointed mountains that look, again, like the Himalayas or the Tetons. And that becomes a theme in the book, both in terms of how we portray the moon, our expectations of another place, and how, as I'm, you know, trying to sort of find my way in either Utah or Tucson and understanding relationships to place, how we accept them or don't accept them. And I think that has implications for the future. So, you know, how we're going, because we're going back to the moon, and we're going back there because we've discovered, quote unquote, a resource. So what kinds of expectations do we have from, whether it's a plaster of Paris model made in the 19th century or some illustration of the moon by a, you know, famous space artist that I write about, Chesley Bonestell.
Chesley Bonestell, yeah. I remember the Chesley Bonestell paintings of the moon especially. And, of course, the dramatic picture of Saturn from Titan.
Yes.
You know, those pictures are so classic. But I remember that the Chesley Bonestell moon was, you know, imprinted in my mind. And I can remember going to see 2001 A Space Odyssey and seeing the moon as depicted by Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick. And then when I saw, you know, the real moon from the Apollo missions, there was kind of almost like, well, that doesn't look like the moon is supposed to look like. Right.
Exactly. There's a sense of disappointment, frankly, for a lot of people. And I think the initial impressions also, and I don't know to what extent the Apollo 8 crew is the first, you know, humans to go to the moon. I don't know to what extent they had the time or capacity or had taken in those elements of popular culture, but their initial descriptions of the moon are really quite negative. And I am fascinated by that. And the Apollo 15 astronauts I write about in the book, I write about both those missions in terms of how they approach place, because the moon is a real place and, you know, there's no indigenous life on it, of course, but time has been on the moon longer than we have, so it deserves some, you know, reflection and respect, and as it is as an actual landscape. But the Apollo 15 astronauts had trained very heavily for that mission. They were basically getting the equivalent of master's degrees in geology. This was the, ironically, like, or strangely, like one of the first real scientific expeditions of Apollo, was the 15th mission, Apollo 15, and they describe the moon in these just enthusiastic terms. It's spectacular. It reminds them of Idaho in winter. All three of the crew members think of it as a kind of home. And there's a quote from Al Warden, who is the command module pilot, who's orbiting the moon by himself, doing all these experiments and taking photographs. And he says in his memoir, beautiful memoir, that it was familiar to him as the streets of his childhood. And so as we project forward, that, you know, what seems like maybe an obtuse and arcane thing, like, well, people illustrated the moon's mountains in this way and they didn't really get it right. Bonestell deliberately, I think, fictionalized it, but it does play with our expectations. So how are we going back now? Well, what, you know, the Artemis crew is going to go back to the moon late next year. Hopefully we'll be landing there, developing not just putting, you know, boot prints on the moon and then leaving for 50 years, but maybe developing a sustained human presence. How do we take the moon on its own terms to the extent that we can?
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the Apollo 15 mission is some of those photographs are so beautiful, and they do show those mountains as being very rounded. You know, they're smooth, but they're majestic.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me to think about Apollo 15 in particular, because like you said, they trained so hard under the great Lee Silver, and with Harrison Schmitt kind of leading the charge there from the astronaut corps, who was the first geologist to go to the moon on Apollo 17, the final mission, that they, you know, really set out to do a bang up job of scientifically exploring the moon on that mission from orbit and, you know, the two astronauts on the ground and on the lunar surface. And that is a textbook mission to me about, you know, how you explore a place.
Yes.
And yet by the time that that mission's happening, the American public is just, you know, even though it's got color TV and it's, you know, got the rover, it's pretty cool. The American public has just moved on from, you know, oh, we've been there and done that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Apollo is such a strange, and I think will continue to be this rich, you know, history because it was a one-off moment. It's unique, I think, in the history of space exploration. It was a geopolitical project, right? I mean, Kennedy didn't particularly care about space. It could have been some other project. He wanted to show the world that U.S. capitalist democracy was better than Soviet communism. And so there we have the space race. And the irony is that the success early on, I think, of Apollo 8 and Apollo 11 really inured the public to the rest of it. And NASA just wasn't an agency at that time. This is different now, fortunately. I think NASA's really good at communicating science. And I think the Artemis II crew, I've had the opportunity to interview a couple of the astronauts. They're very good storytellers. This, I think, began to change in the shuttle era as well. So we have astronauts who are much better communicators, although there's still work to be done. But the success of Apollo 8 and the success of Apollo 11, it's like, all right, well, we've beaten them. We've gone to the moon. That's it. And then we have, you know, golf balls being whacked on the moon, and it just, yeah, public interest diminished considerably. And it's worth remembering that there was really only 1 year in which there was a majority of the American people who supported the funding levels for Apollo at that time. So there are lessons to be learned, and I think NASA's done a pretty good job of learning them. I do think that the astronauts, I'm a poet, I would love to learn a little bit about the compression and just fresh descriptiveness that poetry can provide as you know, encounter an alien landscape. That probably won't happen anytime soon, but, you know, the only trained artist who has gone to another world is Alan Bean, and he came back and he painted the moon for many years. And I think that training helped him understand that place and process that experience. So one of the things that Victor Glover told me recently that I thought was really interesting, because there's, unlike Apollo, which had a very rapid cadence, relatively speaking, the Artemis missions, for a variety of reasons, are going to be spaced out. And so, no pun intended, they will take place at intervals of a year or two or more. And that might actually help us maintain a heightened interest in it, because the missions will be different each time. And they are more ambitious.
Yeah, if you look at the pace of the missions from Apollo 8 through Apollo 13, they were launching Saturn V's to the moon, you know, every few months.
Yes.
And that is quite an effort. And then, of course, you know, with Apollo 13 and the near disaster there, things then slow back down. But like you said, Artemis will be a little more a steady cadence and hopefully sustainable. It's interesting you mentioning being a poet yourself. It reminded me of the film Contact with Jodie Foster, where she's seeing these amazing sights and said, oh, they should have sent a poet. You know, I have no words to describe this. I think that's just kind of a beautiful way of thinking about that.
Yeah, I and poets will get there. You know, we take culture with us.
Artist in residence and at the lunar base, you know, that in the future.
Yes, sign me up. I want to do that. I think that's crucial. But it's also the case that the tools that poets have in their toolkit, metaphor, fresh description, right, avoiding cliche, those are all things that can be taught. And I hope that when the astronauts go and you know, Victor Glover actually has, you know, engages with poetry more than I think a lot of people in science and engineering might, I hope they have that in mind, because we need to convey the moon in ways that are again, fresh, descriptive, and resonant with the sublime beauty. You've talked about how beautiful it is. When you look at the moon through the telescope, and again, if you don't have a telescope, that's fine. You can borrow one from a public library. There are nearly 1,000 public libraries with telescopes you can borrow. You will be awed. It is a sublime landscape. And so I hope that the language always falls short, right, of that kind of landscape or that kind of experience. But gosh, you know, a little exposure to poetry, a little exposure, say, to painting, to the arts can really go a long way to, you know, helping the astronauts convey those experiences beyond photographs and beyond social media posts, as important as those are.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Christopher Kokinos. He's passionate about all things lunar and the author of the new book, Still as Bright, an illuminating history of the moon from antiquity to tomorrow. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with the author of the new book, Still as Bright, an illuminating history of the moon from antiquity to tomorrow, Christopher Kokinos. Another aspect of the Apollo missions that you delve into, and I'm really glad that you did because it's something that needs to be examined, is the dark side of Apollo.
Yeah.
And the connection to Nazi Germany, because, you know, there's the famous line in the movie, The Right Stuff. Of course not. Our Germans are better than their Germans. Where the German rocket scientists, you know, we pulled out of at the end of World War II, of course, the leader being Wernher von Braun, who builds the Saturn rockets that take us to the moon and popularizes space on Disney's programs in the 50s and in magazines and things like that. But there is that truly dark side to it that you delve pretty deeply into and examine. And I thought that was really powerful.
I appreciate that. I've been obsessed by, I'm obsessed by morally compromised visionaries, to be honest. You know, Oppenheimer, maybe Elon Musk to an extent, but yeah, von Braun for sure. He was a brilliant and young man and wanted to build rockets in the 1930s in Germany, and the only source of funding was the German government, you know, and the Nazi government, and he was fine with that. And it is a complicated tale, and the United States was able to put aside a lot of qualms about war crimes, which were committed by Arthur Rudolph in particular, who became the project manager for the Saturn V. And I think Michael Neufeld, the historian at the National Air and Space Museum, has written wrote a great biography of von Braun. And I think it's pretty clear that he was complicit in war crimes as well. But we set all that aside because we wanted to build nuclear tipped missiles, ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, because the Soviets were building them too. So it's also, I think, an exploration for me of how we remember that, not just reciting those facts that are relatively well known to scholars, at least to academic historians, but how, you know, the names of, you know, Kurt Debus, who was a member of the SS, still on a conference center at the Kennedy Space Center, the von Braun Center in Huntsville. Huntsville is where, of course, he relocated with the German rocket team, working first for the U.S. Army and then NASA. He's venerated there, and a lot of the descendants of that German rocket team are, you know, fiercely opposed to even talking about or even just raising these issues. So how he has been remembered, how this team has been remembered, how the slaves who built this rocket, okay, to be clear about this, the V-2 was built, you know, for the Hitler regime to rain destruction on civilians, which it did, killed a few thousand. More people died in the underground, under this mountain factory building the V-2 than died on the receiving end of the bombing. And so the space age, the modern space age, begins in the darkness of a kind of cave, and it has a criminal origin. And just as I make the plea in this book, let's pay attention to the moon as a place and understand its history, to remember it and have a sense of relationship with it that is productive and sustainable and vibrant. Let's also have a relationship that's not fictionalized with the history that got us here. And that means being clear-eyed. And I think that just as description implies ethics, how we remember history, right, implies an ethical stance. And so I very much wanted to tell that story.
Yeah, we see that across the board, really, with American history, of people just not wanting to examine the dark aspects of it, that it's, you know, it's not all wonderful and great, and the founding fathers were fabulous, and isn't America this shining beacon of democracy, when, you know, it's not, you know, frankly, that, you know, that's not what America is. It's got its dark sides too. It's not all great and it's not all bad. There are many great people and many great deeds, but there are also some terrible aspects.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, true across the board. And
the human condition.
It's the human condition, exactly. And being clear-eyed about that is not, that's our responsibility. Like, we have a responsibility to be clear-eyed about that. There's a quote that I have in the chapter on Von Braun. I go down to Florida for the first time to see a rocket launch, and I actually stay in this old motor lodge, the Sea Air Motel in Cocoa Beach, in his favorite room, which was just a very strange experience. But there's a quote in the chapter from the art critic of Robert Hughes, who says, to see yourself as a force of history is to be absolved of both pity and guilt. And I think that is absolutely the case with Von Braun, and might be the case with some of the billionaires who are leading us, you know, in this paradoxical quests being led by very rich people, the wealthiest people in the history of the planet, to lower the cost of access to space. So I think that those realms of responsibility, of stewardship, of inclusivity, of the sublime, of wonder, childhood wonder plays a role in this book. All of those things are percolating, and I keep using that word, but, you know, are in the mix with my book, Still as Bright.
Okay, well, let's go back to some of the fun stuff.
Okay.
Let's talk about TLPs, because I remember when I was a kid reading in Sky and Telescope magazine that, you know, you might want to look at this crater Alphonsus, because there's been some interesting stuff going on, possibly reported there. Transient lunar phenomena. What a fascinating section of your book that was.
That was so much. Yeah, it was fun to investigate that. And, you know, I spent a few hours and still keep my eyes open for transient lunar phenomenon, or TLP, as you say.
So what are they?
Yeah, what are they?
For the uninitiated, what is a TLP?
That's the question. What are they? They are obscurations, little visions of clouds, changes of color, sparkling, lightning. In other words, the kind of thing that W.H. Pickering would have been like really excited to see. But these are controversial. They've been seen ever since, even with the naked eye, right? Going back to the Middle Ages, going back to antiquity, people have seen things on the moon. I think one of the authors I quote, who was very much an advocate that these were commonplace, you know, called it mysterious happenings on the moon. But it's also a story of scientific paradigms and people basically saying this is impossible. Nothing is changing on the moon except the light, you know, of the sun crossing the face of the moon and moving it from 250 degrees below zero to 250 degrees above zero. But there are unexplained instances of these, you know, obscurations and lights, colors. And I tell some of those stories, and I tell the story of two women in particular, Barbara Middlehurst, who worked at the University of Arizona, and Winifred Cameron, who worked at NASA. And they were pioneering women astronomers. Whatever you may think of transient lunar phenomenon, and still the scientific jury is probably mostly like, if things are happening, if they're little outgassings, which is probably what's the cause of much of these sightings, you probably aren't going to be able to see it. But they cataloged these sightings. They set up dedicated systematic searches before and during Apollo, and really argued for taking this seriously. And so their stories, I think, are really, frankly, inspiring to me. Maybe they were on the wrong side of the science. That's how science works, right? You know, you make a proposition, and it gets verified or falsified over time. But there are still astronomers and physicists like Peter Schultz and others who are looking at this, Anthony Cook in England, and trying to understand, you know, how much of this is, you know, actually credible, how many of these sightings are explainable only because the way the light moves across the moon, or are there other things happening like moonquakes and the release of these cold gases, which would explain some of them.
Yeah, it's really interesting just to read about their stories in particular. Okay, well, I want to finish this up at the eyepiece, kind of where we started.
Okay.
You have a 10-inch reflecting telescope where you took up a challenge to find all of these very difficult to see features on the moon. What was that challenge from? What was it from the Royal Canadian? Where did that come from?
Yeah. I had two, actually, and my wife and I joked about it. It was like, you know, I dropped out of, I think I made it to the Weeblo stage of Boy Scouts and I dropped out. So it's like getting my Boy Scout badge for the moon. No, uh-huh. When I first started looking at the moon with, you know, I had a map in my little astronomy library. But the thing about looking at the moon through the telescope is it is overwhelming. It's really easy to see, like it's the moon, you can find it. There are a lot of craters on it, a lot of holes on the moon. And it's like, yeah, there are a lot of holes on the moon. Like, what are all these things? They're named, and those landscape features have stories. So I found online a observing program from the American Lunar Society, which I didn't know at the time was basically defunct. And so I went through this checklist basically to, you know, look at, you know, the Alpine Valley, which is you described earlier, or, you know, the crater Plato, which is one of those places where people have seen transient lunar phenomena. So you just kind of work your way around the moon because it is a very pretty, you know, pretty busy place. There are a lot of features on the moon. And then having finished that, and I got a little diploma, which I have cool. Framed in my office. I don't have my college or graduate degree diplomas up, but I have this one up and the other one from the Royal Canadian Astronomical Society, which was a little more challenging. So if if any of the listeners like, yeah, you know, go take a look at the moon through the telescope, programs like that, there are others through the Astronomical League, for example. They really help you sort of understand not only the names of these places, but what they represent. So if I show somebody Valles Reta, which is on the southeastern portion of the moon, it's a valley and you can see it. But then you learn this is a valley that's as big as the Grand Canyon that was formed in a matter of seconds, not eons of water erosion, but seconds, because the impact that caused the creation of Mare Nectaris, which you can also see with your naked eye, sent dozens of rocks the size of mountains plowing through the rest of the moon. So looking at the moon through the telescope with even just a little bit of that knowledge puts you in touch with, you know, the cosmos and puts you in touch with that sense of wonder that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And then finally, before I let you go, I think my favorite part of the book is just because I felt like I was there with you, was when you get to go to, you know, kind of the holy of holies, Mount Wilson.
Yeah.
And you get to look through one of the world's great telescopes, which at the time of its making was the world's largest telescope, the 60-inch reflector up there, a magnificent instrument. And you got to look at the moon through that. And that was really one of my favorite parts of the book.
I'm so glad. It was a great experience. I initially had projected that the end of the book was going to be a simulated lunar mission at a facility near Biosphere 2 near Tucson, Arizona, called SAM, the Space Analog for Moon and Mars, which was pushed back a year because the facility was still, you know, getting completed. And we actually did that mission in March of this year. But that was like, all right, what do I do? And I had in mind, like, I want to, you know, I've been looking through the 10-inch telescope is a good telescope, but I want to look through them, you know, look through a really big telescope. And so Mount Wilson, which is at the forefront of astronomy in the 20th century, early 20th century. Hubble worked there, discovered the expansion of the universe. Einstein came up to, you know, paid homage to him at Mount Wilson. So there's the 100-inch Hooker reflector, the 60-inch reflector, which was built first and was, as you say, the world's largest for a time. You can buy time. You can get viewing time on those telescopes. So the 60-inch was used for mapping the moon. And in fact, some of those transient lunar phenomenon reports were made because of observations in that 60-inch. So it felt like a kind of pilgrimage. And I'm a secular person, but when I'm in an observatory, I feel, you know, that a sense of kinship and with place, both, you know, being grounded on the earth, looking at the moon, and that sense of connection to the sort of chancy sweep of history. You know, all these people who have walked through this observatory dome. It was an amazing night and difficult to convey unless you've looked at the moon a few times through a smaller telescope, just how astonishing it was. You were just basically a few hundred miles over the surface of the moon because of the magnification of the telescope. And the air was very clear. It was very steady. And so I saw a tiny little, you know, basically half mile wide, third of a mile wide channel that runs through this one valley, the Alpine Valley on the moon. Again, that's going to sound arcane, but we all have our obsessions, right? So it was a spine tingling moment. Writing about it was one of the great pleasures of the book, because I'm coming to the end of the whole project. Not my lunar journey continues, but having that night at Mount Wilson where all these astronomers had been, I felt like I was, you know, it's a small part of that.
Yeah, it was your lunar observer's holy grail, and you got to see it. And I enjoyed it. Like I said, I felt like I was right there with you. It was really well written.
Thank you.
And what a great experience to be at the place where we discovered the expansion of the universe, and Edwin Hubble and, you know, Einstein famously visited there. It was really, really well written, and I enjoyed that very much.
Thank you.
Well, Christopher Coquinos, author of Still Is Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow, thanks for being on Blue Dot and sharing your passion for the moon with us, because you deeply love the moon.
I deeply love the moon, and I hope people will go out and, you know, have a telescope, borrow a telescope, go to the library and look at the moon and have their own journey with it, because it's been with us for a very long time and is an archive of wonderful stories.
Thanks again to our guest, author Christopher Coquinos. You can find his new book, Still Is Bright, An Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow, published by Pegasus Books, at most major booksellers, or order it from your local bookshop. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.